It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Arizona's economy is still in the doldrums. Are there policies that could change that? And are any of them going to be implemented by Governor-elect Doug Ducey and the legislature? Plus, the Arizona Cardinals have the best record in the NFL, which was not predicted by anyone. I'll talk to Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic about why the team is doing so well. We start today's program with a closer look at the results of last night's general election in Arizona. Chris Hurstam, who was chief of staff for Governor Fife Symington and a member of the Arizona Board of Regents, among other things, joins me now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Late night for you last night on Channel 12. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Sure, my pleasure.
So dark money, a huge issue in this race. Let's not get too bogged down in it, but how much of an impact did dark money have on last night's results?
Oh, a huge, amazing impact. Let me just snapshot. 2 years ago, dark money, which is this money that is laundered through so-called nonprofits, so we never find out who really gave the money, and then into independent expenditure campaigns, they dabbled in two ballot propositions just a couple of years ago. We then saw dark money make its exposed last year in 2013 in utility net metering issues, where we saw ads on TV, and it was assumed that APS paid for those. They didn't deny it. Here in this election, the very first time, which we've talked about on this program many times, that there was going to actually impact candidates for statewide elections, $15 million and counting as of earlier, as of last week, $15 million of dark money that went to independent expenditures, those smash mouth TV ads, and 97% of it benefited Republicans. When we went into this election in 2014, there was not one Democrat holding a statewide office in Arizona, and they're still, the day after the election, not one Democrat that's holding a statewide office. So if you don't think dark money had a major impact in that, you're not being realistic. That and a depressed a turnout of Democrats. Republicans turned out about 12 points more than Democrats, and that plus the dark money attacks, Democratic candidates just got washed away.
One narrative we often talk about is negative campaigning, negative advertising, and it works and it works. And I guess it works in the sense that those people tend to win, those candidates tend to win, but is that suppressing turnout?
Yes, I think it is. I think a lot of particularly when 97% of the dark money is against Democrats, that can't help but depress Democrats, I would think. You know, David Brooks, a columnist, political columnist of the New York Times, wrote a fascinating piece on Monday. And I think he was so accurate. He said basically that the 2014 campaigns now, because of the outside spending, that candidates really don't control their own messages anymore. And that the electorate is seen as not as a group of free-thinking citizens, but as a collection of demographic slices. And that these attack ads go after those slices. And that will really have a horrible impact on the candidates, because what it says to the candidates is, forget about talking about public policy. Forget about trying to change people's minds in debates. None of that matters. Just sit back and let the attack ads from outside groups, from the millionaires and the corporate entities that can afford all this now, thanks to Citizens United, Supreme Court decision that allows this, just sit back and let the attacks happen and forget about an honest discussion of public policy. Let the exaggeration and the lies dominate your campaign. But what will it produce? Will it produce candidates that then are in office that have not gotten there because of their views on public policy? Will they then be always afraid that they're going to be attacked in their reelection by these same entities, and so they're just sort of muted? And what kind of leaders or lack of leadership is going to take place in public policy making in our state and across the country? Now, I do want to say something in fairness. I said 97% of the dark money benefited Republican candidates. That's true. That's documented. But that doesn't mean that the Democrats aren't going to eventually get into this playground as well. They can only put up with this so long. And I would not be surprised to see 2 years from now, if we don't have disclosure laws on dark money, which I doubt we will, I think you're going to see the Democrats, you know, and the unions and so forth doing the same kind of stuff, and that'll just make it even worse.
This might be bad news, Chris, for programs like this one, but considering the debates and how some of the debates went, in fact, many of the Republicans tried to avoid some of the debates. We saw Diane Douglas, who looks like she's going to win. It's still very close, but it looks like she has the advantage over David Garcia in the superintendent of public instruction race. Terry Goddard seemed to learn a lot from his gubernatorial race and hit more talking points and seemed to know the issues better than Michelle Reagan. He had huge name recognition, still lost. Are we going to see this even going forward where less information, in addition to more negative campaigning, less information from candidates is available?
Sadly, yes. I mean, Michelle Reagan is a very nice person and is a longtime legislator, and she'll be a fine Secretary of State. But she self-destructed in the couple of debates that she was in on television. You know, just horrible performances, didn't seem to make any difference at all because some dark money came into a supposedly close race in the last couple of weeks, attacking Terry Goddard like they attacked all the Democrats, showing the picture of Barack Obama. You know, tying a Secretary of State of Arizona to Barack Obama, give me a break, it's ridiculous. But that was effective. That was the attack, and the Democratic turnout was depressed, partly because of Obama and because of all the attacks, and it was a Democratic bloodbath with a couple of exceptions in the CD races, the congressional district races.
Well, I wanted to bring that up because is this a clear sign that regardless of the fight with Republicans sort of winning the 2000 redistricting and now Democrats seem to have won 2010 redistricting in Arizona, is this a sign that the Democrats can make it when it comes to congressional districts, but statewide, they're still in big trouble?
It's always the same, Steve. Follow the money. And unlike the state races where the 97% of dark money was against Democrats and they really couldn't counter it, what we see at the congressional district level is it's national. Both political parties shoved so much money into the three competitive congressional districts that they balanced each other out. Then the candidates were still important. Then their on-the-ground turnout efforts and some of their own personalities played a role, but only because the money was balanced. Mm-hmm. It isn't balanced for the statewide elections at this point, but it is in the congressional district races. And I think the Democrats should learn something from Kyrsten Sinema. This is a lady that, for the second election in a row, her congressional district has 10% more Republican-registered voters than Democrats, and she won this time by double digits. That is an amazing performance. Why? Well, she raised a lot of money as a congressional incumbent, so she had the money to play with. But look at her ads. Her television ads, I think, were the best of all of them. First of all, they weren't negative. Mm-hmm. They were almost all positive. And what did she do? She looked into the camera and she discussed issues. Veterans issues, the elderly issues, women's issues. It was refreshing compared to all the negative junk by the outside groups. Mm-hmm. That should have been a lesson learned by other candidates. So she's an exception. Plus, she's got an engaging personality, and she's very articulate and smart. That helps as well. But the congressional districts are a bit different because the money is balanced. Then the candidates still matter when that happens. But with the statewide offices, the outside money was tilted heavily against the Democrats, and the Republicans hung Barack Obama around the necks of every single Republican on the ticket.
Chris, last minute.
A Democrat on the ticket.
Last minute or so. How good a governor is Doug Ducey going to be? He's stepping into a big budget deficit. How big an impact can he have?
You know, I pray that Doug Ducey is successful. He's going to have a lot of Republican types in business community and Chamber of Commerce people all supporting him. He'll have a Republican, very conservative legislature ready to work with him. So let's hope for the good of the state he solves problems and gets the job done. Perhaps it's my old age. I'm 65 now. I've been at the Capitol for 32 years, and I'm becoming too cynical. I try not to be, but I'm starting to wonder whether our state's economy is so tied to the national economy, and that because our economy is not diversified enough, our growth, our comeback from the recession has been hurt badly. I'm starting to wonder whether a governor really can come in and make those kind of decisions that are going to impact. I mean, from a business community standpoint, 23 of the last 25 years, our state's reduced business taxes. We've still got a $1.5 billion deficit. We're right back almost as bad as we were throughout most of the recession. And that's after a very conservative legislature and a conservative Governor Brewer served for 6 years. So you sort of wonder whether philosophy in the governor's office really is going to make the difference and is going to solve the problems versus for our state.
Chris Hurston, former state legislative leader, former member of the Arizona Board of Regents, among other things. Chris, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. I'm joined for a few minutes by former lawmaker Greg Patterson, who's the man behind the blog EspressoPundit.com. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
So what did we learn about Arizona's electorate based on last night's election?
Well, they're pretty unhappy with Barack Obama. We figured that out. And they are reliably Republican. Folks have been trying to say for a long time that, oh, this state is moving to purple on its way to blue, that the Hispanic electorate sleeping giant will wake up, and you know, one more election, we've seen that is absolutely not the case. And Republicans sweep every statewide office. McSally looks like she's going to be Barber. The legislature picked up a couple seats. The Republicans had 36 in the House. It looks like they'll certainly keep their 36 and may even move up to 39. So the death of the Republican Party, has been exaggerated.
Greg, one thing that has come up a lot with our coverage last night, this morning, and of course in months that in the past, is whether and how much APS has influenced things with so-called dark money. On EspressoPundit.com, during the primary, you wrote some very interesting stuff about how Vernon Parker and Lucy Mason in the Corporation Commission race were knocked around. You also had some strong words for the leaders of APS. Going forward, how big an impact is this going to have? Is this going to have a negative impact on the perception of Arizona politics because of APS involvement?
Well, I certainly think so. To the extent that you say that the Democrats have the unions and then later say that the Republicans have the utilities, that's not a good thing, especially since we elect the Corporation Commission at the moment. The question is, why don't we elect judges? And the reason is that it doesn't seem like you can get a fair shake from someone who is a judge who is beholden to campaign contributions. And in this case, we have an elected Corporation Commission to avoid corporate influence. And now the United States Supreme Court has changed it so that corporations are people, too, and they can not only contribute, they can contribute anonymously. And if the perception is true that APS spent a lot of money in this race, well, then folks, including myself, who practice in front of the Corporation Commission, are going to be nervous to make sure they're getting a fair shake at the ACC.
Very interesting. Greg, how much of the losses of Tom Horn and John Hoopenthal in August primary actually end up helping Republicans?
Oh, they helped Republicans tremendously. I don't think that either of them would have been able to win a general election. I think it's interesting that the chamber folks were spiking the ball over the fact that they defeated Hoopenthal, and now they have Diane Douglas. Well, that's what happens when the dog catches the car. So I think that that it's going to be interesting what they have wrought. I'm looking forward to working with Diane. I think we'll work together very well. But I don't think the chamber folks wanted to get rid of somebody like Hoopenthal, who actually for most of the time supported Common Core, and replace him with Diane Douglas, who's unhappy with Common Core.
Yeah, Greg, I know in the past we've talked about the registration advantage Republicans have, and people tend to want to think that independents are moderate. We're seeing more and more that even if they are, they're not really coming out and voting, so the impact has been lessened. But when it comes down to Diane Douglas versus Mark Brnovich, whether this is fair or not, the perception of Brnovich is that he is someone who can run an agency, regardless of ideology. With Douglas, right, People are concerned about that. Is that a fair criticism?
It's fair, mainly because Brnovich is so highly qualified, and Douglas is kind of an unknown at the moment. I think that it's certainly fair in Brnovich's part. I think he'll do a fantastic job at the AG's office. I think he'll depoliticize the AG's office from what it certainly was under, for example, Napolitano. I think she has a lot of groundwork that Hoopenthal has done for quite a few years. I think she can help with that. And, you know, frankly, I think Hoopenthal has good staff at the agency, and I think that can continue. I think they can work with the districts to make sure from an administrative side that it gets done. It's not like the superintendent does that much day-to-day activity in the school districts, and so I think it'll be fine.
Greg, final thoughts on this one. Biggest star to come out of last night and the biggest disappointment coming out of last night? Not even from your ideology, from the basis of what expectations were for a candidate, who was the biggest disappointment?
Let's go back to the rising star. I think I'll play against type here for a second and say that you have to consider cinema a statewide player, if not potentially even at some point a national player. I think that she's done well in a swing district and really is truly a rising star. Ducey is, is the first governor who's younger than I am, which always shocks me. It's like the first time you see a dentist who's younger than you. And in this case, Ducey's 50-ish. And I clearly will have a tremendous, I think, time on the Arizona stage, but also on the potentially federal stage as well. He's going to be a governor who makes a difference. You're going to hear about him nationally. So I think those two are rising stars. I think there's a generational shift at the moment. We've got a lot of folks who are young folks who are doing well. I was surprised that Tobin didn't do better against Kirkpatrick. If you want to look at a disappointment of the night, that would be it for me. But having McSally defeat Barber is what it looks like is happening. I think kind of assuages that a little bit.
Former lawmaker Greg Patterson, you can read his opinions online at espressopundit.com. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at how prisoners are treated in Arizona. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Fruitkin Law Firm, attorney serving Arizona's business owners and you. For more information, you can visit them on the web at fruitkinlaw.com.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Sunny and clear conditions around most of Arizona right now. It's 50 degrees up in Flagstaff, 55 in Prescott, 73 in Casa Grande. It's 71 degrees right now in Tucson and 78 in Yuma. In Valley traffic on the Loop 101 northbound at Via Linda, watch out for a vehicle on the shoulder that's on fire. And on the Valley surface streets, there's a report of a chemical spill on 79th Avenue at Utopia Road in the North Valley. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Mr. Jim Seward and Ms. Julie Karsis, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Sunny skies and 76 degrees in Phoenix at 1124.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last month, the Arizona Department of Corrections reached an agreement in a class action suit with the American Civil Liberties Union, among others, on behalf of 33,000 prisoners. The suit alleged that prisoners haven't received adequate medical, dental, and mental health care, which has led to deaths. There were also allegations of excessive use of solitary confinement. With me to talk about treatment of prisoners is Caroline Isaacs, Arizona Director of the American Friends Service Committee. She specializes in privatization of prisons and solitary confinement. Caroline, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In a general sense, what are your biggest concerns about how prisoners are treated in Arizona?
Well, it's a long list, but certainly in terms of the medical care, the state of things in Arizona is really beyond the pale, and every expert that's been brought in, the various attorneys in the cases have all remarked, these are experts that go around the country and look at these things, and everyone pretty much across the board has said that it's one of the worst situations they've seen. And certainly as an organization, AFSC corresponds with incarcerated people and works with their families, and we're seeing that as well. The number of complaints, the severity of complaints that we've heard actually spurred us to do a report on this after the original suit was filed, to say, since that was initiated, how are we doing? Have things improved? And sadly, what we found were that the same problems were continuing.
Solitary confinement, I think a lot of people, I hate to say this in such a silly way, I guess, but many people have seen it on television and they wonder, it must be an unbelievably horrible experience to be put in that position. And I'm wondering, is solitary confinement being used inappropriately? And how are conditions going to change based on the settlement of the suit?
Yeah, absolutely. Nationally, the issue of solitary confinement has come under quite a bit of scrutiny. A number of lawsuits across the country have brought major reforms in quite a few states, mostly due to, very scientific research that shows that those conditions of confinement actually produce a discrete set of symptoms of mental illness, similar to what you see in prisoners of war. people who are in isolation conditions like, you know, Antarctic researchers for long periods of time. And so what we find is, you know, in Arizona, people with mental illnesses are more likely to wind up in solitary confinement because their behavioral problems cause them to break the rules. They cannot follow the rigorous rules of a prison. They get more and more tickets. They get written up for their behavior. They end up with a higher classification, and boom, they're in solitary. And on the flip side of that, the conditions in those units actually make otherwise healthy people display symptoms of mental illness. So we're really creating problems and not solving them.
Why has this tended to be an option then that's so often used in prisons?
That is a great question, and I would, you know, refer to your later speaker from the Department of Corrections. I think that, you know, DOC administrators want to have as much control and as many options to control prison violence as possible, and that is a legitimate need. However, you need to know that the difference here is between disciplinary confinement and administrative confinement. So disciplinary is your cool hand Luke thing, right, that you see in the movies, right? You get in trouble, you shank an officer, and you end up in solitary. What we're talking about here is administrative segregation, right? This is a virtue of an administrative decision made on the basis not necessarily of your behavior in prison, but of a number of other factors. So everyone on death row is in solitary, whether they are a present risk to other people in prison or not. We have people who are actually in what they call protective segregation because they're at risk of being injured by other prisoners. Like, these are the folks that need to be protected, and the way that we're protecting them is putting them into conditions that literally make them insane. So I think that it is safe to say that these conditions are being overused beyond really any legitimate correctional need.
Mm-hmm. Is this based on the perception that we have dangerous people and we need to sort of break them in a sense? Because there is that, there are some who on one side will even laugh at this idea of rehabilitating certain convicts.
Certainly. I mean, and there's no question that there are folks who are a danger to themselves and to others, and there need to be ways to keep those folks safe. However, what we're doing is not necessarily making them any safer is the main issue. We're actually making them more dangerous and violent. So you see the number of assaults in these units, right, where they're supposed to be not able to assault people, are really much higher. So if we go back to the roots of the problem, that's how you solve prison violence, right? You treat people with mental illness. You don't give them mental illness. And so it's really a false solution to what I think we all agree is an important problem, which is making sure that people are safe.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Caroline Isaacs, Arizona Director of the American Friends Service Committee. She specializes in privatization of prisons and solitary confinement. Caroline, speaking of privatization of prisons, how much has that made some of these issues more daunting, more obvious, worse?
It's a fascinating question. Actually, in our report that we put out in October of 2013 entitled Death Yards, we actually trace a lot of the problems in terms of medical care to the advent of privatization of the medical services in DOC. Because what happened was, of course, this was originally a mandate from the legislature. This did not come from the Department of Corrections. The legislature says, thou shalt privatize medical care. And so then DOC has to do that. DOC's first RFP, request for proposals, was essentially impossible for any company to meet. They wanted them to provide medical services at or below the cost of 2008. And I believe this was in 2010, right? Can't be done. So what happened was, everything is in a holding pattern in terms of treating people within the system because they're waiting to privatize and they're going to hand it off to whatever company gets the deal. Well, you know, 3 years later, there are people who had been going without treatment for all this time, waiting for this company to step in. Then, of course, we had the debacle with Wexford, which is the first company that got the contract, and promptly, you know, one of their nurses exposed over 100 prisoners to hepatitis C because she did not correctly use a needle. They lost the contract. It was handed to Corizon. And unfortunately, under Corizon, we've seen the same pattern of problems continue. And so, you know, whatever your thoughts about privatization, it's clear that the buck stops here with the Department of Corrections. This is just a subcontractor. If they're not given the tools, if they're not given the leadership, and they're not given the funding to properly treat people, privatization is never going to solve these problems.
Caroline, final question for you, and this comes back to sort of the perception of the general public. I'm going to generalize entirely here, but this perception that once a person is in prison, that person must have done some pretty nasty things, and, you know, I'm not necessarily as concerned about some of the issues they face. Do you run into that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the most important questions that we can address. And there are three answers to this: why should we care? Number one is because the Constitution mandates it. And the Constitution is a document that we in Arizona have great respect for. And just like the First Amendment, I may not like what you have to say, but your right to say it protects my right to say it. Okay? Secondly, we have over 40,000 people in prison, and that's a lot of family members affected out here. I think it's really important to recognize that 7% of state prisoners are in for murder. 1.3% are in for rape, right? 20%, over 20%, are in for drug offenses. Now, how many of us out here have a family member who struggled with addiction, have a family member who struggled with mental illness and gotten in trouble with the police? I mean, we're hearing a lot about that in local jurisdictions. So, you know, there but for the grace of God to some degree, and it's very important to remember that, that these are our people. They're not some other species. And third, if you just really don't care, it's a public health issue. So it has to do with you and me, right? So if people have chronic and infectious diseases that are going untreated in these facilities, that's going to come out here to the rest of us, whether through the staff that are exposed to those conditions, whether to people who are released, to the family members that go and visit them. So ultimately, this is our problem, and it's our responsibility, not to mention the fact that we are paying for it one way or another. And as with any kind of medical care, it's pay now or pay later. We are spending over $8 million on this lawsuit between the cost to the attorneys for the ACLU and for the state. How much would it cost for preventive care to completely eradicate this problem, right?
Caroline Isaacs is Arizona Director of the American Friends Service Committee. She specializes in privatization of prisons and solitary confinement. Caroline, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
And now we're joined by Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media, former director of communications for the Arizona Department of Corrections. Barrett, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you this fine day?
I'm good. So what improvements has the Department of Corrections made? And tell us more about what's going to happen after the settlement of this class action suit.
Well, you know, the Department of Corrections actually has made a significant amount of improvements over the last few years in their medical care. You know, doing medical care in prison is very difficult. First of all, you're dealing with a population that oftentimes isn't in the best of health when they come into the system. Generally speaking, these are people who are heavy smokers, maybe drug addicts, alcoholics, who don't do yearly checkups and things like that. So it's a population, generally speaking, that isn't healthy, as healthy as, say, the general population. So they come in with sometimes significant health issues. And, you know, they haven't gone to the doctor in a long time. Well, now they have free access to medical care. The department spends currently about $130 million. That is a lot of money, $130 million to medicate and take care of prison population, about 33,000 inmates in a state prison system. Or under the state control, there's 7,000 or so in the private, and the private prisons take care of them. But $130 million, significant amount of money is spent, and you know, they work hard. There's a reasonably new, last several years, monitoring system in place to ensure that proper care is given, and the system allows for proper care. So they watch what is being done. These monitors watch what is being done in each institution on a better basis than had been previous to that. So that's a real big improvement.
Bert, I want to come back to one thing as it relates to budget and spending. One thing that Caroline Isaac said was this idea when there were bids going out, this idea of trying to come under the 2008 budget, for example. And I know that all these different departments, when the economy went down, the state was bringing in less revenue. But considering the fact the Department of Corrections is one of the biggest departments when it comes to budget spending, are there improvements that could be made? You mentioned $130 million. Is that money being spent well?
Well, yes, it's being spent well. Again, $130 million, you know, you've got to attract and retain doctors and nurses. You're paying for a lot of medicine. One of the things in prison is someone who is sent there for life in prison because they have done murder or some other heinous crime, you know, they're going to get old and they're going to get infirmed, and you're still taking care of them. Sometimes those are the sickest people. Your elderly, and while we do have a compassionate release here in Arizona, it's not used very often. So you are taking care of people who, quite frankly, are sent to prison to die because of their heinous crimes. So they may develop cancer or diabetes or need dialysis just like anyone else in the general public. And so you are now paying for that expensive care in prison for an elderly person who, you know, you're just sustaining life, essentially. So, yes, they are finite dollars, but they are being used in the best way possible. So it is a system that sometimes, you know, there are breakdowns in any system, individual cases, but it's a system as a whole that is meant to provide the constitutionally required care.
Barrett, finally, considering the folks who are in prison, considering the perception, at least, of the folks in prison. Again, there are a lot of people who don't have great empathy for the situation, but based on something Caroline Isaac said about even the public health situation, the idea that, you know, we would like people to be healthy, so if, in fact, they're just on the streets next to us, how much of a concern should that be?
Well, sure, and again, that is why the department spends such significant resources, more than 10% of its budget on inmate health care. I think they spend about, give or take, $4,000 a year on inmate health care and per inmate. So, you know, that is a significant amount of money to, again, a population that isn't taking care of itself when they're not in prison. So they have bad habits and make bad choices. And so now, for the first time sometimes in their lives, they're actually getting good and timely medical care.
Barrett Marson of Marson Media. He's also the former director of communications for the Arizona Department of Corrections. Barrett, thanks.
You bet. Take care, Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona's economy could still be described as sluggish, especially when it comes to job growth. Is there something more that can be done, or is a slow cycle at work? And how could last night's election results affect things? With me for a few minutes is economist Dennis Hoffman of the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Hi, Dennis. Dennis, good morning. Are you with me? I will go to Dennis Hoffman in just a moment. Dennis, are you with me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well, good. I'm glad I can hear you now. Good morning.
Okay, excellent. And how are you, Steve?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming
great.
On. So how much of this sort of lethargic Arizona economy has to do with policy? How much is the economic cycle? How much is Arizona just affected by national and international trends?
Well, all of the above.
Okay.
But let me just put the target squarely at the economists this time.
Dennis, this is on tape, you know.
I don't think I could find Pardon me?
This is on tape. We're going to have this recording. If you're admitting economists made a mistake, I want you to be ready for that.
Oh, my. I am very ready.
Okay.
Everyone that I could identify, I think, across the state in terms of mainstream economic forecasters, you asked them 2 to 3 years ago what would Arizona's economy look like, and we described it in very, very upbeat and optimistic terms. And I think that's what everybody heard. That's what everybody's expected. And so, therefore, the stalled-out economy, as you've described it, and I believe that's exactly correct, it comes at a surprise to many. And I would say that the economy began to stall out about 15 months ago. So what's at the root of the challenge or the problem?
Mm-hmm.
The old drivers that have really sustained Arizona are just not hitting on all cylinders. And I start with aerospace defense. You know, you can point the finger at sequester and just slower times for the Department of Defense. The globalization hitting our electronics manufacturing sector. And so, therefore, the expansion in those areas is simply not taking place. Best example there would be Intel, a tremendous firm for us, but they've not expanded at the rate that many of us had thought. Finally, folks are just not evidently enamored of the state in the numbers that they have had historically. So historically, we have been the recipient of 75 to 100,000 new residents each year, kind of in this unrelenting stream or march toward the Sunshine State of Arizona, and that has definitely slowed. So we're doing okay in that in migration compared to other states, but the volume of the movement is just slow. And as a result, you know, there's some things that are really shocking. Goods-producing jobs, jobs associated with the goods-producing industries in this state, we're in the 40s. We rank in the 40s across the nation. Our neighbors are doing much better. Utah, Colorado, Nevada, Texas, Oregon, Washington, even California, goodness sakes, is doing a bit better than Arizona. So comes as a surprise to many of us in the economics field and a challenge, obviously, going forward for policymakers.
Well, yeah, and Dennis, considering the budget deficit the state faces on top of that, Doug Ducey has been talking about how he's going to have a broad coalition. He's going to have these ideas. He's going to bring more entrepreneurs to Arizona. Are there policies he could implement that could make that happen, or are his hands going to be tied based on the budget deficit?
Well, we need the state marketed. So if Governor Ducey can help with marketing the state and moving the state forward in that regard, kudos to him. And we all need to just lock arms and march with him on that and put the broad agenda forward. But that agenda has to include things that will make businesses move, and that is workforce skill, infrastructure, a solid infrastructure, a place where they can come and prosper. And I've said this repeatedly, and I'm not saying it just in reaction to some of the positions Mr. Ducey's taken, but my position has been repeatedly, if folks were going to move here for low taxes, Steve, they'd already be here, by and large. Now, we do have some business tax challenges on the margin that could be looked at, but we've got some tough choices to make at the budget level. Now, fortunately, the governor is coming into this situation. I think the team in OSPB right now with John Arnold as director, and I don't know what the governor's plans are, but I've worked with a lot of budget directors down there, and that team is solid. And John is just a very stabilizing force, incredibly knowledgeable, and I think well-received by both the current administration, executive branch administration, and the legislative branch. So I think John could provide a lot of knowledge, especially in a year that's really been a challenge.
Yeah. Dennis, final thoughts for you on the two ballot initiatives that were not statewide. One was the county, the Maricopa County Hospital bond, which is Prop 480, also Prop 487, which was defeated, pension reform in Phoenix. Brief thoughts on those in terms of going forward. a bond effect on the county? Is that going to affect it economically? Is having the new county hospital going to be a real plus economically in any sense?
Well, full disclosure, we did some background research on this particular bond initiative, 480, and we did find a tremendous potential for economic benefits across the entire valley and, in fact, across the state. So I think that taxpayers are going to find that they've made a very good choice in terms of a long-run investment in health care and building the health care and science base in the county. So I think that's very good. Pension reform is going to be on the docket, I think, going forward for the next few years, trying to figure out what the optimal amount of expenditures on public employee pensions is going to be a challenge in front of us. At the end of the day, our cities, though, have to be able to recruit and retain top talent in an area, police and fire, that is absolutely vital to all of us. At the end of the day, we may have to be paying more for that, and we're going to just have to figure that out.
Economist Dennis Hoffman of ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. Dennis, always nice to talk with you. Thanks.
Very good, Steve. Take care.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic for a few minutes. He'll explain how the Arizona Cardinals have the best record in the National Football League. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Oncology, together with the U.S. Oncology Network, bringing evidence-based cancer care to communities across Phoenix. Together, a better way to fight cancer. More at arizonaoncology.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Should be a nice day in the valley today. Sunny skies, clear with a high of 83 degrees. It'll be clear tonight again with an overnight low of 58. And more sunshine tomorrow and Friday. The high each day expected to reach 84 degrees. NPR's Here and Now is coming up today at noon. We'll have special coverage and analysis of yesterday's election. And stay with us at 1 this afternoon for international news from the BBC on NewsHour. Checking Valley traffic on the Loop 101 northbound, there's a disabled vehicle on the shoulder at Via Linda. And on the Valley surface streets right now at 79th Avenue and Utopia, that intersection is clear again after an earlier chemical spill there. Sunny skies right now, and it's 76 degrees in Phoenix at 11:48.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Arizona Cardinals have the National Football League's best record so far this season at 7-1. That follows a 2013 season when the team went 10-6. And this is not an organization used to consecutive winning seasons. And because the Cardinals' home stadium is the site of the 2015 Super Bowl, people are actually talking about the team hosting the NFL's championship game. So what's going on? With me for a few minutes to explain is Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. He's been covering the Cardinals for about two decades. Kent, thanks for the time.
You're welcome, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So how much of the success has to do with head coach Bruce Arians, who was 60 years old before he even got a shot to be a head coach?
A lot of it. He's really has the players buying into his system. He has a real knack of, I mean, he's blunt and honest in his staff. They coach these guys hard during practice. I mean, they're not afraid to yell and scream and call people out, but they have a real knack of being able to do that and yet relate to players after practice and get players to understand, look, this is, we're doing this for, you know, to make you the best player we possibly can. And, you know, I think the whole thing has fit together better here than it ever has in the past in terms of management, coaching. You know, I think general manager Steve Keim and his staff have done a better job than anybody in the organization has for years in finding players, finding the right kind of players and players that fit this system.
I suspect anyone who follows football at all in the Valley remembers Kurt Warner when he had his late career renaissance with the Cardinals. The team's had a few years with, it would be, I think, generous to say below average quarterbacking. So how much of a difference does it make to have a great coach with Carson Palmer, who had some issues in other places but also proved at times he could really play?
It means everything. In the NFL, if you don't have a quarterback, you're not going to win. And, you know, that's one of the first things Bruce Arians and Steve Keim did when they took over in January of 2013 was, you know, start to identify the quarterbacks they needed. There really wasn't anybody already in the organization they thought was capable of of leading them. And when Palmer had a contract squabble with the Raiders and became available via trade, they really jumped on it. I mean, he's Arians' kind of quarterback. He works very hard. He's studious. He's tall. He can throw the deep ball. Not necessarily mobile, but just a mature quarterback who's seen a lot of things in this league and who could learn this system relatively quickly.
We talked about this being the team with the best record in the NFL. Do you think it's the best team in the NFL right now?
You know, I don't know. Probably not. I think, you know, you look at New England, they're probably playing better right now than the Cardinals are. The Cardinals lost badly at Denver. I would probably put Denver ahead. But, you know, that said, this team has been very efficient. It doesn't make a lot of mistakes. It doesn't turn the ball over a lot. What they've been able to do defensively has really been a surprise, given all the personnel changes over there and the injuries. I think coordinator Todd Bowles deserves a ton of credit. So, you know, I think maybe on a neutral field, the Cardinals are on par with, say, a Denver or New England. And the Cardinals, if they meet those teams, hope it's not on a neutral field, that it's University of Phoenix Stadium on February 1st.
Well, what do you give them the chances there? They've already had some significant injuries. If they avoid an injury to Carson Palmer, where he's out for more than a week or two, can they do it?
Well, I mean, two or three weeks ago, I would have, you know, sort of chuckled at that and thought, no way. But here we are halfway through the season at 7-1. They are just getting into the real tough part of their schedule. But, it's possible. I certainly don't see anyone else in the NFC who's playing any better or see anyone that this team can't beat. And if they continue to play well and get home field advantage through the playoffs, it's a possibility. It'll obviously be difficult. It always is. But I think it's possible.
Kent, all of us in our jobs, you long time in the media and me as well, always talk about teamwork. We always have bosses talking about, we're going to come together as a team. In a locker room, how important is that, and how tangible is it?
I think in the NFL especially, it is really important, and it can mean everything. The differences in talent from team to team, it can be very little other than at quarterback. And I think, a real key are getting those guys in the locker room, 53 guys, 61 if you count the practice squad, to sort of believe in what the overall goal is, then they kind of put their egos aside. And that's really hard for a lot of guys, especially with the money they make. And especially, I think more importantly, they've grown up their whole lives as being the best player on their team or the best athlete in their school, et cetera. It's hard for them to sort of, subjugate themselves and take a lesser role. And they've really done it here, and they've been able to survive injuries by just assuming that the next person who the replacement is going to be just as good or almost as good as the guy he's replacing. And it's all the cliches are flying around here, one game at a time, next man up, all of that stuff, but they're really putting them into practice, and it's working.
Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. He's been covering the Cardinals for about two decades. This is probably one of the more fun seasons he's had. Kent, thanks for squeezing us in.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Phoenix Symphony and Phoenix International Raceway don't seem like they'd have much in common, but the new Sound of Speed is an effort to change that perception. With me for a few minutes to explain is Phoenix Symphony CEO Jim Ward. Jim, welcome.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So the Sound of Speed, what is it? How did it come together?
Well, it's a bit like Reese's Pieces. It's peanut butter and chocolate, which you might not think would taste good together, but it certainly does. We were fortunate to have been able to reach out to Phoenix International Raceway to see if there was any intersection at all. We knew this town is car crazy, and fortunately, this year is Phoenix International Raceway's 50th anniversary, and they decided that they could, in fact, reach back out into the community and help organizations like the Phoenix Symphony. And so we began that journey. And along the way, Craig and Carolyn Jackson of Barrett Jackson came on board as well to basically create what we're calling a collision of cars, racing, and music.
And Jim, correct me on this. Is this tonight or tomorrow night? I want to make sure.
This is Thursday, November 6th, tomorrow night, beginning at 5 o'clock. There's basically two sections to this, Steve. We're going to shut down 3rd Street outside of Symphony Hall, and we're going to bring down, or I should say Barrett Jackson is going to bring down about 30 cars valued at $60 million, rare cars that people have never seen before. We're going to have food trucks and music and just a great Pit Road fan festival outside. Then everyone's going to move into Symphony Hall for a new ground-up production that is going to be a multimedia event. We're going to hang a big screen above the symphony. We'll play live, and we're going to pay tribute to cars in the movies, cars in TV commercials, F1 racing, NASCAR racing, everything you can imagine that cars and music intersect, and there are a lot of areas that they do, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. It's all going to be hosted by none other than Tom Wopat, one of the original Dukes of Hazzard, who's a very big race car fan. And we even have Rusty Wallace, the famed NASCAR driver and ESPN analyst, who's going to be conducting the national anthem, and then a lot of other drivers as well. It's just going to be a lot of fun.
Well, you mentioned a tribute to cars in movies, and there's a certain perception of going to the symphony. You've tried to change that, of course, to try and make it more open. It's not quite as, let's say, stuffy, for lack of a better term. What kind of music are people going to hear? How are the symphony musicians affected by what's going on around them?
Oh, my gosh. We're going to have a wide range of music. During the montage of cars in the movies, we're going to be playing the Back to Future suite. People know that and love that. We're going to do a tribute to Cars and Gadgets in James Bond movies. And we have a wonderful singer named Scarlett Rabe who's going to come out and do Skyfall with us. So that's going to be a lot of fun. But also in our tribute to F1 racing, we're going to be playing classical music that everyone knows in a very dramatic way. And then we're going to be playing rock when we get to NASCAR. So it's a wide range of music, but it's absolutely accessible. Everyone, I guarantee, will know every single piece that we play. And it's just a tour de force for the symphony. It's a tour de force for racing. And we're just so excited because we have so many people coming down.
Jim, there are always these challenges when it comes to arts and culture, especially the more traditional arts groups. When you try something a little bit different and something that's so elaborate like this, how do you get them to come back for something that is more standard?
Well, I think, I don't think folks who sample us tomorrow night are ever going to come back and be our hardcore classic subscribers. But what we do have is a broad array of music. We have an amazing pop season. This season, we're bringing in the music of Led Zeppelin and Queen and Neil Diamond. We've brought in Cheyenne Jackson a couple of weeks ago. We have a lot of different types of music for everyone. And I think if people can sample that and understand that, then they will understand the value of the asset of the Phoenix Symphony to our community and the entertainment value that's there.
Well, you do sound really pumped up about this. How excited are you about this event? I mean, is this something that can really spawn other things as well?
Well, absolutely. Listen, I think this was a wonderful way to intersect with this community. We've been working on this for, almost a year. And I think it's going to be wonderfully successful. And we could annualize this. We could do this every year and celebrate cars and racing and music. Why not? And so we're very, very excited about it.
Jim, in general, when you came in, the symphony was struggling, had been for quite a while. You've made some pretty dramatic changes. What sort of shape are you in right now?
Well, we're in great shape, Steve. When I came on board, the symphony was not doing very well. Flash forward almost 4 years later, we've turned around a structural deficit and a lot of debt into 2 years of surpluses. We've paid down all of our debt. We have been through 4 separate negotiations with our musicians and their happy campers, and so we're very stabilized right now and very excited about all of these new kinds of things we're now being able to do, including the Sound of Speed.
Jim, finally, do you have a favorite car-related song?
Oh my gosh! Well, I.